Hi and welcome. This is Dave. I hope you each have had a chance to catch up if there are any of the seminars that you've missed. I really appreciate all the feedback and the responses that you have, and I want to be sure that we cover any remaining questions or things that might be helpful to discuss before we move into our final seminar. We're going to look at specific challenges and opportunities in transition, and I want to look at some special situations and particularly applications for mentor coaching that I think that you might find useful and stimulating. But I want to engage with any questions that you have or things you'd like us to discuss or things you want to bring up to elaborate a bit about from any of the three previous seminars. Anyone? What's been your experience in the first three seminars? What has been the primary thing that you're walking away with in the seminars, and is it what you anticipated? One at a time now. Anyone? Any feedback of any sort that any of you have?
Dr. Dave, this is Hadley. In
Thank you. I was beginning to feel lonely there. Go ahead. I appreciate it.
I have to say, I am in the process of transition and also interested in coaching and navigating clients through transition. But it has been fabulous for me because I'm like, listening to the lectures, and I am right on that path. So everything is meaningful to me where I am. But I think the coolest thing is I have exposed, because of this transitioning and being aware and listening to the information you share, have exposed limiting beliefs that have been holding me back all my life. And if it hadn't been for this course and going through this process and just being aware and present, I might have spent another 20 years with limiting beliefs. So thank you, and I can't wait to share this with clients and help others.
Well, thank you very much for that feedback, and it's good to know. And here's the secret. We all are going through change and transition. Everyone of the clients of each of you will be navigating some aspects of change and transition. So these dynamics and these aspects are important, and they're very viable principles to incorporate into our coaching. It may not be a career transition, as ours has been. Each of us began, I would guess, in a different career, and we've made a transition to professional coaching. But change and transition is an ever-present, ongoing dynamic and developmental step, and it always will be going forward. So I think it's important to really look at and understand that, understand our own. And the very best way to help our clients develop a new story is to understand our story in the fullest way. One thing that you might do with what you mentioned, Hadley, and I'd suggest each of you consider this, to write down three beliefs that stand in your way in some way, personally or professionally. Some belief that is getting in the way, creating a glass ceiling, creating less of opportunity or advantage that you want. And also then write down what your life would be like in 10 years as you look back. How will this change affect your life? Where will you be in 10 years looking back to see how it's changed because of addressing this belief? And then, what would your life be like 10 years from now if you didn't change? What would you miss out on? What would you give up on? What would be compromised? So play it out with both scenarios, 10 years from now looking back. And there's an exercise I want us to do at the end that relates a little bit to this, but I don't want to take away from the impact of that because this stands alone, and I appreciate, Hadley, you mentioning that, because that's exactly what we're looking at, and the importance of understanding how, when we say that 90 to 95% of our operating systems are not conscious, what we're looking at doing is to make them conscious by looking at the behaviors, at the choice architecture that we engage in with our clients and with ourselves, and to infer then the beliefs to see what we need to change, how those beliefs that ghostwrite behavior and that give commands, the software that commands our behavior, how we may change that. And that's exactly what we do with our clients and can do with ourselves as well. So excellent point, and thanks very much for making that. Other thoughts or other input or other questions? Any other experiences that any of you have had about what this has done for you or for looking at your coaching practice? Any other changes that you've been aware of by highlighting this process and crystallizing the awareness of it? Anyone? Well, let me perturbate that by moving into the material and then saving a bit more time at the end to look at questions or interaction that you have, or just reflections on your experience of going through this and what it's done for you. Okay, we're going to talk about specific challenges and opportunities in transitions. And specifically, first, I want to talk about niche coaching having to do with transitions. Here are some considerations just to think about. This is kind of just to sort of perturbate your awareness of this and to think about applications if you're looking at directions to go or what you might be able to do with this. Practicing professionals like healthcare, financial, legal have in common that they've dedicated their careers to a body of knowledge. Their clients come to them for the purpose of purchasing their expertise. Their expertise to solve special problems and give specific advice is often backed by professional standards, substantiated by an entire body of knowledge. Even with rigorous training to solve specialized problems and provide specialized advice, professionals probably have not been trained to know themselves better, understand the dynamics of human behavior, remove stress as an obstacle to their success, pursue personal development as vigorously as they pursue professional advancement. And I'm talking about the entire range of practicing professionals, you know, healthcare, financial, legal, and performance professionals, actors, pro athletes, other performance professionals. To convert from work ethic to performance ethic, and they've probably not been trained to emotionally and strategically manage career transitions because many of them assume they do one thing, the profession they train for, all their lives. That was certainly my assumption in teaching and practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis and being clinical professor of psychiatry at Baylor College of Medicine. Another genre, performance professionals, as I mentioned, includes actors and professional athletes. The primary challenge these clients have is self-regulation, to stay grounded in their ideals and energy management in the face of extraordinary demands and stimulating success, especially retirement transitions for pro athletes. Now, here's a lesson we can learn about the importance of self-regulation for all loss, change, and transition. Champion sports figures are alert to the importance of aftermaths, the points or the play immediately following a tense and hotly contested moment of play. So we can learn a lot from them. Both the winner and the loser of these intense encounters tend to be weakened in the aftermath. The winner is excited about the victory. This carries over to affecting the next play. The loser is frustrated, which also carries over into errors or trying too hard. And think about the applications here about boardroom negotiations, divorce mediation. The aftermath point and plays are likely to be lost on the errors or getting caught up in the emotion of a lawsuit or a contest rather than the business of it. The wise player approaches the aftermath with self-regulation, whatever the aftermath is, conservatively and with full concentration. Let me give you an example. The announcer at a Texans game on defensive lineman Casey, that's so often the case with young players. One good play and then one bad one. After doing a spectacular tackle on the next player, on the next play, Casey was offsides. Clearly an instance of self-regulation and being on tilt, the excitement from making a really good play. Now, success does not create an immunity to failure. A loss does not foreshadow lack of confidence or disbelief. The next play is the next play. The next point is the next point. You've lost something very important, yet tomorrow is still the next day. So often, as I've worked with one pro athlete in a non-flow sport, which is football, whereas basketball is more flow, and the regulation became reset after every play, because no matter what happens, you have to reset for the next play. You have to get grounded and centered for the next play. Your career is the same thing. This is the aftermath of everything you've done before, everything you've worked hard for. It will stand alone on its own, just like the next play. Additional people who have significant challenge in dealing with the emotions of transition are the ones whose process begins with a significant and abrupt job loss, or some abrupt loss, a significant relationship, a disability, or divorce. When things are sudden, especially when they're external, as we've discussed before, these changes and subsequent transitions, the need for help in managing emotions and regulating states of mind is important in itself. And this is not therapy, by the way. This is here and now, the choice architecture of this moment, made from a regulated state of mind. And that's a two-step process, as you remember from the chart that you have, that recognizing and addressing how to get grounded and centered, and then to make the choice of an ideal response, the neuroconditioning chart. Then this task becomes important as it affects other components of the situation. For example, the significant emotion of a divorce and the subsequent divorce proceedings and asset management create challenges such as making the business aspect of the divorce only about the business of the divorce and not letting emotional factors derail logic and judgment. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older, as another example. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. A place, for example, that I see this challenge in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he began 36 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and function. Now, another example. I'm doing a series of retreats with a good buddy and colleague called What's Next Exec for current senior executives and CEOs or business owners who are within a year or so of retirement. It's designed to help them create an informed and masterful transition to their next contribution or career. Many of the executives we've seen at this retreat have been in corporate America for three decades or more and want to retire to pursue their own business, their own consulting, or even coaching or another career. They've not had the experience, for example, of setting and collecting professional fees, of operating by creating their own structure. They've been surrounded and supported by a corporate structure. So their challenge is analogous to those of you who move from a paid position to opening your own coaching practices. you know much of what they're going through. They've never had to market their services, set up a PayPal account, establish a business name, or find somebody to do a website. So for them, retired is not an identity. It's the lack of one. It's the beginning of something new. So in looking at this entire process that we've been talking about in terms of change and transition, what do clients want from us? The mentor, coach, and client become co-authors of that new story and create a current meaning that allows the distinctness of the old versus new in an evolving new story. We're always teaching others how to respond to us. A client is always teaching us what it's like to be her, creating an in vivo demonstration of what needs to be known so that we can teach it back to her out loud. We must be open to that learning and not let teaching the client our theories or let our agenda get in the way. Although we inevitably listen within the context of our own system of meaning and knowing, we continuously bridge to the experience and system of meaning of the client. In this co-created space, the client develops an authentic story. What our clients want from us as mentor coaches, I believe, is the adult version of what we as children wanted from our parents. Our clients want unself-conscious participation in serious work and sometimes in play. Remember the words of my favorite grandmother, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. They want acceptance of praise, that we have acceptance of praise without embarrassment or deflection, so that we can give it back to its creator as self-statement. Full immersion in, yet not full reaction to, their full feelings, never losing sight of their internal perspective and best interest. To hope that we will see the self the client hopes to become and see the evolving new story that sometimes gets obscured from the client's view. To see at times a thought, a feeling, or behavior as an answer to a question its creator has not consciously dared to ask. Now, I stole that directly from X-Files, but I'm sticking to it because I think it's important. To hope that we hear the silent intent embedded in the compromised result, to see the hope camouflaged in the frustrating process, to validate their intuition. To hope that the coach will not be awkward, self-conscious, or say anything that would distract from the client's immersion in his process. The architecture of trust silently forms while we talk about other things. Collaborating together, even laughing together, gives hope to oxygen, gives oxygen to hope, highlights the relief and release of new experience, and pushes creativity to full flight. We help the client mourn the old story, to know that no matter how ready to change the client is, it's still like saying goodbye to an old friend who's been there for a long time. The client mourns the self that he leaves behind, the self of the old story. Invention can be sabotaged and creativity imprisoned by remaining in an old story, repeating the same storylines. Julia Cameron said it beautifully in The Artist's Way. I am astonished that I could let go of the drama of being a starving artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. We are in the present moment together, the client and us, and co-create a new story with our clients. We believe in someone until they can believe in themselves, and they teach us both why. The corollary to believing in the client is that the coach must be the kind of person in whom the client can believe and respect and trust. The client has to believe the coach will respond, guide, teach, and model in a way that facilitates growth. This bond, this immersion and understanding within the present moment may be one of the most powerful and most change-making experiences that the client has ever had. Probably the most. I remain curious about how my clients continue to write their narratives after we end formal coaching. I believe that coaching is a developmental process continuing in its influence throughout life. I've said to clients, I'm going to be your coach for life, though regular meetings will be necessary only for a short period of time. Intervals of updates, maybe quarterly, maybe at least once a year, can be beneficial for both coach and client. Booster shots, witnessing a continuing developmental journey at regular intervals. What we do with each client is not about being right, not about having pristine theory and technique, or even mutually idealizing achievement. But the bottom line is, does it work? Coaching allows the beauty of waking up to specific possibilities, strengths, untapped resources. We help people become more of who they really are. The client now must risk bringing an issue to the table and further that risk by looking at it. The exchange must be worthy and true. It must be real. The coach must be fully present, fully himself or herself. I believe Hemingway captured this principle very clearly when he wrote about the craft of writing. He said, write the truest sentence you know. As we nudge a client to consider their relationship with themselves, we wonder, sometimes out loud, let's look at your important storyline in this regard. How exactly are you taking care of yourself? I ask clients often, how do they treat exercise? How do they work out? And I'll not so gently nudge. And I want to get into that in just a little bit, the wellness story. How are you honoring your needs and ideals, your relationships? Have you created something now that seems to be controlling you? Are you framing yourself by your gender, your role, your purpose? Do you daily find things to be grateful for, to celebrate? An ideal coaching co-creation is to reflect or validate the client, to tell the client what they already know and just a little bit more. That little bit more may be a challenge, a conceptualization, a nudge toward initiative or action, or a reminder to pause momentarily to consider, contemplate, or celebrate. So here I believe are 12 caveats about how we facilitate change and transition in coaching. 1. Each person's life story is created. Recognition and acceptance of story ownership is a prerequisite to assessment and change. Remember the first two steps of the roadmap. Recognize and own your story. 2. Understanding begins with examinations of which storylines work and which do not. Then, to change the ones that don't work. The ones that work need to be kept, possibly enhanced. Remember we talked about, in its elegant simplicity, you do more of what's working, and if something doesn't work, do something different. 3. Knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. And you may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost know what it isn't. Now, I took that from an old codger who was one of the counselors on the alcohol treatment service that I did a little bit of my time in my practice, and he gave me permission to use it whenever I wanted, so there it is. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. 4. Distinguish what to change, what to accept, what to let go, and what to enhance. Placing energy into what works, coupled with accepting and letting go of what can't, can change results for significant effectiveness. 5. When people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. Questions direct, clarify, illuminate, and even at times story bust. 6. Someone has to change an internal model of assumptions to sustain the new story. They have to program new change, the P of the roadmap. They have to evolve and have a transformation of their identity along with behavior to identity. 7, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Learn to recognize your own assumptions and beliefs and how they color what you perceive. Assumptions manifest as feelings and behaviors. By making assumptions explicit, those which facilitate and those which interfere can both become visible. 8, change is constant and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that generates most problems. People are most successful when they learn from yesterday, anticipate tomorrow, and integrate the impact of new experience. Consider this. If someone is protesting change, they've already engaged it. 9, small changes lead to big changes. Issues that seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. For example, professionals may get overwhelmed with the amount of tasks and responsibilities. Don't be afraid to get simple. Focus on and clarify one issue that can be dealt with effectively within the next day. This focus on a specific action exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. And just because a professional has completed the 26th grade, especially don't be afraid to get simple, because this may be the one elusive aspect that is most needed. 10, solutions, causes, and problems are not always related or even interconnected. The therapist, for example, attunes to problems, conflict, and development for progress to occur. Coaching uses this space to focus on creating a new story to align the client's needs and values or ideals to strategize toward the client's goal. The coach listens to join talents and strengths with possibilities and vision to strategically pursue goals. 11, a collaboration keeps both individuals on the same side looking at the same scene together. And this is our model, one of collaboration. Empathic resonance generates a feeling of being understood by the client. Then you can make powerful coaching interventions. Also, validation of what's positive will have several times the effect of the focus on the negative. A comment perceived as judgmental often results in a defensive reaction. And finally, 12, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't will become evident and self-perpetuate. And again, I want to reiterate, don't be afraid to be simple. How you work with your client provides a model that will be imitated, ultimately how they work with their patients or their clients, and especially the model that they internalize to use for themselves. Let's consider now, for just a moment, your wellness story. Think for just a moment. If you were to say in one sentence what your wellness story is, what would you say? A significant aspect of a change and transition is to build a new wellness story. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to the individual. With this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be really different than if from the beginning you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life. You'd probably do research to know the best care for the car, probably change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing it would be the only car for the rest of your life, you take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. Your body is irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. Wellness is a system of energy, Wellness is also an ongoing process of choices. It's never static. We never stay at the same place, so it consistently needs to be assessed. Wellness is not something you begin to plan at age 65 or even 50, but it's a choice you make every day that writes your wellness story. Here's an illustration of those little choices. Overall wellness is not based on the big monumental choice, but on little things. If you plan to run 30 minutes on the treadmill, but get off after 10, convince you're a little stiff today, it's one small choice, no big deal. No one has a heart attack because of 20 minutes less on the treadmill one day. You resolve to cut empty calories, but then grab a few peanut M&Ms from the candy bowl, not really thinking about the choice, because no single M&M, not even five, cause anybody to have diabetes. Take in 100 calories more each day than you burn, and in 1 year you gain 9 pounds. Little things count. Our wellness success is the cumulative result of daily choices that we don't rationalize away or justify into oblivion. Now, we are in a revolution in the science of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. This has taken a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. Let's consider this. The story that we engage with our body is one of two possibilities, decay or growth. Dr. Henry Lodge Jr., who wrote a best-selling book called Younger Next Year and a companion piece, Younger Next Year for Women, says that 70%, and he's dedicated at this point almost 35 years of his professional life to wellness research. He's an internist in New York City. I came to know him. We read each other. We shared a venue. And I'm a terrific fan of his work. According to Lodge and his findings, 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. If we assume that ailments and deterioration are a normal part of growing old, and that we diminish activity and deteriorate physically as well as in quality of life, the change on the cellular level will correspond. It will be decay. Inactivity and the absence of signals to grow result in body and brain decay. Another story is that both decay and functional aging are largely optional. This alternate story is growth. We send signals to our bodies of daily exercise, emotional meaning, good nutrition, and zest for living. Here's a quote from Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. Now, the new wellness story includes a central storyline of exercise. No negotiations, no excuses, serious exercise. According to Lodge, after age 50, 6 days a week for the rest of your life is mandatory. He emphasizes that 4 of those 6 days of exercise need to be serious aerobic exercise for the rest of your life. Because of this, biologically, your body only knows 2 things, growth or decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body, and each bathe cells in repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels, and it's wounded blood vessels that result in deterioration. Mortality falls with exercise. Now, of 3,000 people surveyed, 3 activities stood out above all others as ones that prompted procrastination. And think about how these 3 things, we all know exactly what to do in each of these 3 areas. More than anything else, people put off exercise, nutritional plan, and retirement plan. Saving money, in other words. Short-term desires usually trump long-term goals and emotion rules. On the other hand, think about it this way, and this is how Lodge suggests to create a mindset about it. Work duties, projects, assignments are responsibly and routinely responded to. In other words, you get up, you go to work each day, you don't think about it. You don't debate about whether you do or don't go to work. You don't feel virtuous if you do. You don't say, well, you know, I'm going to knock off a few days now, but I'll go beginning Tuesday next week. And think about how you may do that with exercise. Work is there. You get up, you go to work. You don't debate it. It's an organizing force, a deeply etched default mode. You go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, including full-time parenting. Exercise can be the same mindset. For some, this is like a job. It's a full commitment, a serious commitment. It requires a plan, just like a business. According to Lodge, daily exercise, like work, should be right up there, trumped only by serious illness or family needs. The default story. Now, as a mentor coach, you're not a personal trainer. You're not a dietitian. You're not giving directives, but you can make informed recommendations, and then you can listen to how your client takes information and makes choices to write the next chapter. And you're always free to challenge the choices or the trail of logic leading to them and their fulfillment. Here are a couple of findings, just to belabor this point just a little bit more. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells in our central nervous system: enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. The hippocampus is the part of the brain that's especially connected with two things: creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment, when there's the equivalent of intellectual and emotional stimulation, have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. The area of the brain having to do with creativity and memory. Now, this finding was very recently replicated in non-invasive studies in humans in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. A related finding: chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number and complexity, the size, basically, of the hippocampus decreases with chronic stress. So this, I think, is important to consider in terms of how we're looking at helping our clients develop a new story, deal with change and transition, because this is a natural remedy for some of the stress that people inevitably experience. Let's look at, for just a moment, at your future self. I want to do that with an exercise in just moments, but look at your future self in terms of your identity. There was a study done by Princeton psychologist Emily Pronin, who found that in making financial decisions, especially how much money people put away toward retirement, depends on how closely we identify with our future selves. What she found was that people who have a better picture, a better visualization of their future self as they, for example, get older, save more for retirement by 2 to 3 times. Brain imaging reveals that the greater activity in an area of the brain called the anterior cingulate cortex is activated when you imagine yourself in the future. And the greater alignment you have with that future self, the more you see it as this is part of me in the future in a continuum, including the greater amount of savings for the future since it's aligned with identity. Now, very recently, there have been a couple of studies. One including, and this was, I think, very fascinating and has some great promise in a number of areas, to show people computer-enhanced images of themselves as they age. And what they found was that this affected their saving for retirement by about 3 times. They're also showing computer-enhanced imaging of someone going through life as they continue to gain the amount of weight they have in the last decade, what it will look like 3 to 4 decades from now, if they do exercise, if they don't, if they continue smoking versus if they don't, you know, to look at what is the expected trajectory. And this is extremely impactful for a number of people. So when people in this original study showed a lesser activity in thinking about their current and future self, they tended to save less money. So the conclusion of her original study was that encouraging people to imagine themselves in the future can help them save more. And these studies that have come about by computer-enhanced imaging, especially some out of Stanford, these are showing some really early remarkable results. So you can do this without computer enhancement, and I want to get to that in a moment. Now, your story hides in plain sight. Think about the difference of people who lead a reactive life where circumstances and others determine their decisions and directions, who talk about what they're going to do, but who do the same thing week after week. Now, by contrast, instead of reactive, consider the proactive people, those who accomplish and believe they have a different story in them, that their lives embody and can embody that story for themselves and others. That's exactly why each of you have chosen to do the work you're doing. You're alchemists, people who believe in the transformative power. The story within, the plot, guides you, orients you to the script you consciously write. Now, through these seminars, we've talked about how someone's story is hiding in plain sight. It's in the open, waiting to be seen, then transformed. In these seminars, we've been discussing how to help people write the next chapters of their life and business stories. So consider these questions. If your story to this point would be published as a book, what would be the title and subtitle? If your story builds to a major achievement in the near future, what would that be? Describe a scenario in your story in which you, the protagonist, faced a major setback that brought out the best in you to successfully overcome it. What aspects of your story do you want to enhance? What aspects of your story do you want to leave out as you move ahead? What events or process foreshadows your next success? What roles will the most important people in your life play as you go forward? And finally, what is your spiritual essence? Remember, you don't have to be religious in order to have spiritual meaning, significance, and purpose. Your spiritual essence, how would you describe that? Let's look finally now at the life stages of success. Now, this is moving beyond what we've used at times the close-up lens, the macroscopic lens. At times we've used the wide-angle lens when we looked at the dynamics of change and especially of transition. Let's move now to time-lapse photography. Success may mean different things at different points in adult life, at each developmental phase. Here are some quotes, and I'm a consummate collector of quotes because sometimes in a quote, you can capture so much that would take so long. And here are some things that I've collected that I hope will be useful to you to look at this time-lapse photography from different perspectives. The first is how it may look in a relationship. And this is from Ruby D, I Dream a World. It takes a long time to be really married. One marries many times at many levels in a marriage. If you have more marriages than divorces within the marriage, you're lucky and you stick it out. Here's one way of looking at individual success. This is Wolfgang von Goethe. Whoever in middle age attempts to realize the wishes and hopes of his early youth invariably deceives himself. Each 10 years of a person's life has its own fortunes, its own hopes, its own desires. Dreams change. We realize some, we relinquish some, we create some new ones. Growth is hopefully flexible and dynamic. once you achieve success, monetary, professional, personal, you can figure out what's really important. Ideally, if you really want to achieve massive success before. So a caveat here, be sure success doesn't constrict you from doing what you really want to do. Now, here's that time-lapse photo from a different perspective. This is from one of my favorite essayists, Emerson. Not in his goals, but in his transitions, man is great. I'd like to do a final exercise with you. I'd like you to get in a very comfortable position. And if you can, get completely relaxed in a chair. If you are listening on a phone, if you can tuck it, find some way to get completely relaxed so that you can really focus on my words. Breathe in a deep breath of relaxation. Breathe out any tension. Be aware of how fully and comfortably and securely your chair is holding you. And close your eyes. Take another deep breath of relaxation and breathe out any tension so that you're focusing only on my words and what then your mind will focus on because of that. Keep your eyes closed. Imagine you're 90 years old. Look back at yourself now. Look at how things will turn out on your present trajectory. How would they turn out on a different path? Does the difference between the two suggest a change, a transition? What kind? Be specific. From 90 looking back, what do you see that you might have really seen right now but didn't acknowledge or didn't want to see? How do you feel about your situation now? What do you want to tell yourself now? For example, any turns or cautions or risk that you should or shouldn't have taken. Keep your eyes closed and look now carefully at your 90-year-old eyes. Your face. Your hands. Your 90-year-old body. Look around at where you are. And at who's there with you. Remember, you always know more than you think. I'm going to go back to discussion mode, but open your eyes gradually and slowly, and let's talk whenever you feel like it. The transition back is sometimes a little more gentle or takes a little bit longer than you may think. Whenever you're ready, I'm interested in your thoughts or questions or reflections about anything we talked about today or anything in the series thus far that you'd like us to talk further about or any impressions you have.
David, this is Allison.
Hey, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. That exercise we just did was very powerful. Is this something you have used with clients, and how effectual has it been?
I have not used it with clients. I use it in I do it in the New Life Story Wellness Coaches training. So I use it as a trainer, and I've used it in a couple of live seminars. And the response is usually how powerful it is.
Yes.
Because it really looks at oneself in a different way.
Yes, that was great. So would you suggest that we just know about it but don't use it with clients?
I think you can use it whenever you find that it might be helpful.
Okay.
You know, I would do whatever with a client that I feel would help them get in a better way to their goals and better achieve their goals. So whatever it takes, the principle here is not what you should or shouldn't do or rules or whatever, but the principle is whatever you can do to help the client better achieve their goals. So
thank
if you.
You
feel it's useful, go for it.
All right, that's good. Thanks.
Yeah. In regard to that, I did a guest shot at a group of coaches that were fairly senior coaches. They had each been practiced for some time. What was unifying about them is they had all trained at a particular training institute, and they wanted me to come and present a case and talk about some of my work and perspective and that sort of thing. And I noticed as they presented the case and began discussing it that it was curious that they were only talking about asking questions. And I said, "Now, do you do other things than ask questions?" I said, no, coaches are not supposed to do anything but ask questions. I said, "Where in the world did you get that notion?" They began to talk about that. That's how they were trained. So I then challenged that and said, "Let me tell you about some things that we do. There are a lot of coaching interactions that we do. Asking powerful questions is a principle, not a rule. It's not a Procrustean bed that you need to fit yourself onto, but it's a principle because it focuses attention and helps someone direct a state and energy. But think about the number of things we do. In addition to asking powerful questions, let me name some. We endorse. We endorse our clients' concepts and ideas when they work, when they highlight creativity and wisdom. Sometimes we mirror. Sometimes we reflect back to a client to get them to look more closely at something they said that sounds a little goofy or doesn't make sense. Sometimes we summarize. Sometimes we reframe to look at things in a different perspective, to move to a new level. Sometimes we simply brainstorm. We each, the client and I, have a wealth of information and ideas, and probably if you were to listen in, as I told them, to any two-minute segment or any segment with a client, you would think it was a brainstorming session because we're both going after it and looking at things, throwing ideas on the wall and see what works. Sometimes we offer insights and ideas. Sometimes we strategize, and this is probably the bread and butter. We look at SMART goals and those kind of things. Sometimes we simply explain something to a client that may not make sense because they're too close. They either have the macroscopic lens fixed or the wide angle fixed. And we may an example would be, well, you know, it seems like the universe is conspiring against me to present obstacles as I get more successful. And you know, I may point out, you know, I understand how you feel that way, but when you move ahead, you become aware of bumps in the roads. And if you weren't proceeding, you wouldn't encounter those bumps. So this is part of the process. Sometimes we advise. We can see a blind spot. We can see an area that a client is never going to get to, no matter how many questions. Sometimes we story bust. Habitual behavior, limiting assumptions, beliefs that are not conscious, things that don't work, that are still in evidence. Sometimes we simply give information. You know, if someone doesn't know what an AMWA is, you can't coach it out of them. Sometimes we train and direct, like giving a model of how to handle conflict, including communication skills. And sometimes, as we've discussed, we help a client regulate states of mind and to discern what state works best for a particular task. So those are just some of the things that we do in addition to asking powerful questions. So the principle here for all of this is we do whatever helps the client proceed to reach goals and maybe even beyond them, because we can only imagine from our own system. So a client will often achieve well beyond what they had initially imagined, because the same thing that was limiting their imagination was limiting the ceiling of their success. So when that's removed in a new story, anything's possible. So I hope that, I know that's a way longer answer than you bargained for, but I think you ask a really important question, and I hope this is helpful to consider. Other thoughts and questions any of you have? I promise to be more succinct. Any other things that you've learned that you didn't expect to learn, or things that you have as important takeaways? When I do a coaching group, or when I do my mastermind group, we end each group with looking at what was the most important thing that you are taking away from the group today. What was the most important thing you learned? And then what do you commit to do between now and when we meet again? So anybody want to take on either of those questions? Anything important any of you learned, personally or professionally? I mean, we spent 4 hours together. I hope it's meaningful to you, and I'm curious about what you think. We still got just 2-3 minutes. Anyone? I want to keep this open. If you want to email me or do any follow-up to any of this or clarification, please feel free to. It's been a privilege to work with you, and I appreciate the input that you've had, and I hope it has been as meaningful as you had imagined in the beginning, and perhaps and hopefully more so. I hope it's had an impact for you, and mostly sort of opened you to think about things in different ways and look at possibilities about change and transition, and give you some tools and some ideas about helping your clients in that transformation and perhaps in the process in your own. So thank you, and it's been a privilege working with you. I welcome any feedback or input that you have, and you have my email for that. So thanks very, very much. And I hope we cross paths again. If I can be of help to you in any way, please let me know. Thanks again. Bye now.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Definitely.